So we're going to talk tonight on the subject of pornography, but especially I want to talk about the subject of digital dilemmas that we face in our day and time. In times past, we have not had such issues as we have today. A lot of the sins that took place at the corner convenience store or took place in some clandestine setting, those sins now have, many of them have transferred themselves to our internet and to our phone systems. And it is not uncommon to hear of brethren who struggle with such things as misuse of their cell phones, or as they struggle with misuse of their laptops or other devices that they may have. So tonight I'm going to be talking about kind of the subject of digital addictions. It so happens that with cell phones, that many of our younger generation get real glued to cell phones. You ever go to and sit and eat in a restaurant? And I eat by myself a lot, and I used to feel a little self-conscious when I'd sit there. And then what I'd realize is I'd look around, it's like, well, other people sitting there by themselves too. They're just at the same table. And they're sitting here just doing all this stuff on their phones and very distracted one from another. When I talk with young people in some of the clinical sessions that I do, what I find is such things as Snapchat and Facebook is not as much with the younger people, but Snapchat and some of the other social media places, many of the young people are out there and kind of preoccupied with that. It is not uncommon among even members of the church to be solicited to send sexting pictures. Take a picture of yourself without your clothes on or without some of your clothes on and send it to me. If you really love me, do that. Just kind of accept the dare. And there are several who have responded to that. And as a result, they have exposed themselves sexually before some person, or maybe it's been forwarded and they forward that to somebody else out there. So such things as this have not been heard of maybe so much in previous generations, but it's a problem with some of us today. Part of the problem is that it operates on impulse, that whatever it feels like at the moment you can have sent halfway across the world just in the click of a button or the touch of a mouse. We have a number of people that are caught up in even such dilemmas. When I talk to young people who are in a courtship relationship, people in the church, I sometimes will ask the question, well, has this person sent you any nude pictures or have you solicited those? Sometimes they'll say, oh, yeah, I've got one, but it's just for my eyes only. Well, guess what? It shouldn't be for your eyes only. It shouldn't be for anybody's eyes. That should not be out there. But we have some redefinitions of some old things out there. Even the terms of sexuality have been redefined. The famous Bill Clinton quote with Monica Lewinsky, that he had not had sex with that woman, and then we find out later the type of sexual thing he had. There are many young people that do not define sexual activity in the same way we do. When you redefine it, then you can take away some of the guilt. I had one young lady, and I'm going to talk a little plain tonight, but not so plain that I'm vulgar. At least that's my goal. But I had one young lady that I talked with, and she said, "Oh, I'm saving myself for marriage. I haven't gone all the way." And then as I talked with her, it's like, "Well, this sure sounds like you've been all the way," as the way I defined it. But what she told me, she said, well, when I'm with my boyfriend, if I leave my top on or my bottom on, one or the other, then I haven't gone all the way. So when I get married, that's when I'll take both pieces off. But she had been sexually active for some time, but she had redefined it. And by redefining it, she wasn't feeling the guilt. And I think that's pretty naive. But in this case, I think I believe this young woman. She'd been told that, and she bought into that. So when we talk about sexual sins, we need to be sure we're talking about the same thing. I'm finding folks today that they've heard lessons on fornication, lessons on homosexuality, lessons on adultery. They've heard those all their life. And yet, some do not define those words, or don't even understand how to define those words as the Bible defines it. Now, I have to ask the question, where have people been? We do talk about those things. But I end up asking this question, and that is the question, where did you learn the facts of life? Now, I realize I'm in a farming community, and things may be a little different out here, as we've got animal husbandry and all that kind of thing that takes place out in our rural areas. I understand that. But many people do not know the facts of life. And parents and other family members that may explain those facts of life, sometimes they're very hesitant because we're embarrassed by such topics. And I want to suggest tonight that far too long have we been embarrassed about topics that the Bible talks about openly. And we need to share with one another and with our families as we talk about the fact that we are sexual beings. The Bible, while it is not a sex manual, is full of sexual things. I was in a meeting up in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and I was asked to talk on the subject on one Sunday afternoon to go in the Bible from Genesis to Revelation and talk about human sexuality. And they said, don't worry about how long it takes. I have the record for the longest lesson that's ever been preached there, and I was flying to get through all that. But I want to suggest to you that the Bible has a lot to say about it. So I want to ask the question of you, and you answer for yourself, where did you learn about the facts of life? Did we learn them from God, or did we learn them somewhere else? And I want to suggest this, that if we have not learned about the facts of life from a reputable source, then we have learned about the facts of life from the devil. And the devil is a great tutor. What he will do is he will teach you what he wants you to know. And if that is not countered by healthy and wholesome views of human sexuality, then we're going to end up with a perverted sense of the facts of life. Along that line, what we see is that everything God made is good. Human sexuality is a good thing, but it is only good in the realm where God has placed it, and that is in the realm of marriage. But Satan has tried to take the sexuality and take it outside the realm where God put it, and has got people to where they are just their mind is sex saturated. Peter talked about those that had eyes full of adultery that could not cease from sin. That everything about them was pointed toward sexuality or toward being sexual. But when I look at how God views marriage, God in the Old Testament had a number of death penalties, capital punishment. And I want to list some of the sexual things for which there was capital punishment. Such things as incest. Now that, by the way, is rampant in our day and time. Incest is having a relation with a close family member. And in Leviticus 18, 18 verses are spent talking about how this ought not to be. Now, why do we have this kind of thing in some of our culture today? Part of this is because people behind closed doors in their homes aren't careful around one another. And I want to suggest to you that nudity in a family can, if we're not careful how we are, how we sit, how we act, what we dress, or how we're undressed around one another, that we can evoke some feelings that ought not to be. There was a gentleman that I talked with from a congregation. He and his wife came to talk to me, and it didn't take very long before it's like, whoa, we got to back off on this one. Not because it didn't need to be discussed, but what he shared with me is he'd gone forward in services the day before, and that he had been having a sexual relationship with his daughter since she was 3 years old. The wife did not know about it until the daughter, at that time 19 years old, got mad and yelled at Dad because he was peeping in the door at her in the shower. Such things ought not to even be open for discussion. But as we dug down into this a little bit deeper, what we found out is she had three sisters, and he had done the same with each of them. Now, incest, that's what that is. And this is something that we have to guard against. Be careful how you dress around people. Be careful how you're dressing in your own house. We even know that in the time of Noah, that there was a problem where his sons looked on his nakedness. I'm sure I don't understand everything involved in that because the Bible doesn't reveal all of it. But I do know that there was a curse that was placed upon his son because he beheld the nakedness of his father. We need to be careful about how we dress around one another. Adultery is generally defined as sexual activity with a person on the part of a person who is married, who has committed himself to someone else in the sexual relationship. That's adultery. Rape was also talked about in the Old Testament. As a matter of fact, incest, adultery, rape, and some others we'll mention in a moment, these are all capital punishment. People were to die if they did these things. Well, when we look at rape, there was an exception to that. If a maiden was raped out in the country and there was no one to hear her cry out, then she could get away with it. But the penalty for rape goes further on, and unfortunately, I think, the women, if you got raped, you had to marry your rapist. And that would be a penalty, that would be kind of a consequence. Well, whoredom was condemned. It was something for which people were stoned in the Old Testament. Then bestiality, that is having sexual relationship with an animal. And that was something that not only was the individual to be destroyed, but the animal was too, such that this would not continue. That's rampant. It's back and it's in full bloom in our day and time as well. Sodomy, that would be homosexuality. And this was condemned in the Bible. In the book of Genesis, as well as in Leviticus 20 and verse 12, and the Old Testament. And what it says is that anyone who does this, men with men or women with women, that they are to have the death penalty under the law of Moses. A non-virgin bride, someone presents himself on the wedding night, and if they don't have the token of virginity, that is, if there's not indication that they haven't been with a guy before, then that virgin bride was to be stoned to death. That's the penalty. The very clear message here is that under the law of Moses, under that Ten Commandment law, thou shalt not commit adultery went broader than just adultery. Thou shalt not be immoral is how it was explained as this gets down into detail. How does God view sex outside of marriage in the Old Testament? He views it as something that those that do this are worthy of death under the law of Moses. Now, when I come to the New Testament, I end up with something that is very similar, except the death penalty has been lifted, but the consequences still, there are still consequences to immorality. For instance, in Matthew chapter 5, we read there that a man should not look on a woman to lust after her. That if he does so, he's committed adultery with her already in his heart. Now that passage tells us that we don't have lustful eyes. We're not ogling the women, nor the women looking over the men. And yes, women and men can both lust after the opposites. But we're told here, and we're going to look at that in some detail a little later. But I just want you to get the picture of what God has to say about this. The word fornication is used in the New Testament as well, and there it is a broad term that is inclusive of homosexuality. In the book of Jude, it is used of the men of Sodom who committed fornication, and thus sodomy also is included in that broad umbrella of fornication. We read also that we're not to commit fornication. Romans 1 and verse 29 talks about that being in the list of those that were condemned, and what I call the roll call of the damned, and that's in there. Adultery, cheating on your marriage partner, that is condemned in the New Testament as well, as we all know. I want to suggest on that one that when we take a marriage vow, I promise to keep myself for you and for you alone until death shall separate us. That's a covenant vow. What is that vow? If you made such a vow, and if you're married, you very likely did, I promise to keep myself for you and you alone. Not you and me, for me to go off in the room and mess with myself, or for you to go out here and do something with yourself, but we promise to keep ourselves for that person and that person alone, meaning you are the only one who can sexually satisfy me without us being at odds with God. That's what that means. That's a covenant. That's the promise we made. And thus, our marriage partner is the only person alive that can fulfill that sexual need. No wonder 1 Corinthians 7 says, do not defraud one another, except it be by consent for a season, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer. Someone asked me, how much is a season? And one fellow defined it as winter, fall, summer, and so forth. I don't know if he's talking about the seasons of the year, but what he says is that we need to be careful that Satan in the marriage relationship, that our sexuality is frequent enough to where Satan does not tempt us with us not having a continuous relationship. How frequent is that? Husband and his wife need to make that decision and not to withhold themselves from one another. 1 Corinthians 7 needs some air between the pages, and we need to read that because there's a lot in there about relationship in marriage. Well, the word lasciviousness is also used in the New Testament. And what that means is basically anything that inclines you to lust. That may be something you see on TV. It may be some provocative catalog that you may have in your house. It might even be a magazine of some sort. Maybe it isn't even a pornography magazine, but it may have some stuff in there that presents a problem for you. And if that's the case, then we need to get that stuff out of our house. These things that are devoted to promoting human sexuality, they don't need to be in the Christian's house. We need to get rid of those, just like they had to get rid of their idols in the Old Testament. Such things also, such like Galatians 5 and verse 21 says that anything like these things can cause us to be lost. Now there's a concept that we have lost in our day and time. When we have children that are born out of wedlock, we've coined a phrase called baby mama. And the Bible doesn't call it baby mama. The Bible calls it bastard. And Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 8, there it uses the illustration that children born in a marriage relationship have a special bond with their mom and their dad more so than a child that is born outside of a marriage relationship. And here in Hebrews 12 and verse 8, if we don't understand that concept, that children born out of wedlock are not equal to those born within wedlock. If we don't understand that concept, we won't understand that passage. Well, we also look at such things as whoremongers. A whoremonger is someone who is out here basically going around trying to find out who they can seduce. These are the individuals, and often a whoremonger is a male. But whoremongers and adulterers, God will judge, we're told in Hebrews chapter 3. Start to get the picture. God doesn't like us to express ourselves sexually outside of the marriage relationship. Sodomy is condemned in the New Testament. We're told to flee fornication, that those who commit fornication sin against their own body. Well, also we find in 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 3 through 8, that it there says that we are to possess our vessel in honor. I'm going to look at that verse in some detail. What that's telling us is that part of our anatomy that makes us a male, or that part that makes us a female, we need to treat those parts with honor. We don't go around flaunting these. We don't go around tempting people with these or teasing people with these. What we do is we act honorably. As I said, I'm going to look at that in some detail. When I ask people, and this is part of the subject of pornography, I ask Christian people, what is the frequency of your sex life in your marriage? And unfortunately, what I get is that there are some issues with some people. In other words, there can be physical roadblocks where a person may not be able to perform properly because of some physical thing going on. Sometimes people aren't able to function. Their parts don't work right. And so they have physical problems doing that. Sometimes a person maybe have some problems with their heart or with part of their system where they can't get too worked up. And as a result, they've got to be very limited in how they express themselves sexually. Sometimes there's physical roadblocks. But when I ask those that don't have those physical roadblocks, what is the frequency of your sexual relationship? Here's some answers I've gotten. 4 times a year, if I'm lucky. That'd be once every 3 months. And that gentleman said, that's not what I signed up for. Someone said, well, once a year. Another person says, well, never. We haven't had relations in 8 years. Another said, well, every 6 months. And then one guy told me, he said, well, on my birthday, if I've been good that year. Well, 4 times a day is what someone else told me. That may be a little too frequent. Or then the average 2 to 3 times a week, except during her menstrual cycle. Well, those are answers that Christians around the country have given me. I'm a counselor, if you're not aware of that, but as well as a preacher. But those are some answers that Christians have given me. Now, here's why I've got that in this lesson, not just to shock us or to say things like that, but to say this, that while we're talking about pornography being a sin, I want to tell you that sometimes people go to pornography because they're driven crazy by the infrequency of their sexual relationship in their marriage, and their partner is not innocent in this. Now, I didn't say they were the cause of their pornography, but Satan tempts some people through their incontinency because the frequency is not where it needs to be in the marriage relationship. Now, there is a word in the Hebrew language, yada. And that word yada, Y-A-D-A, is used 960 times in the Old Testament. It is the word for intimacy. Now, we have defined so many words differently than the Bible does. When I ask people, are you all intimate? They think I'm asking, are you all having a sexual relationship? That's not what I'm asking. Because the word yada, out of those 960 times, all of them, but 63 of those times, it is referring to the relationship between a person and God. An intimate relationship. That we know God. We know Him intimately. And He knows us intimately. That's not sexual. It's about closeness. It's about a bond. The other times it's used in terms of a marital relationship. And there it is describing that bond that is there between a man and a woman. Now herein we go to Ephesians 5, where a man is to love his wife as Christ loved the church. And I want to suggest to you that that many times people don't have an intimate relationship, but they expect a sexual relationship. And so here comes a guy in the door. We haven't said I love you in a week. He comes in the door and he's ready to go hop into bed. Well, we need a little intimacy. In other words, closeness. The feeling of being loved, of being needed, of being wanted, and not just in a sexual way. And if that's not there, it is going to be very difficult for a woman to submit herself to her husband because the bond is not there. The intimacy bond is not there. And thus, there's a strain in the relationship. Let's listen to God about this. He talks about the works of the flesh are manifest, and he lists those. He talks about those without natural affection in Romans, the first chapter. Talking about those burning in lust one toward another, men with men, women with women. Looking to lust is talked about. Eyes full of adultery. Evil, look at this. Evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. Who are these people? Well, they're evil to start with, but what are they? They are seducers. What's that imply? It's people who are seductive sexually, getting people to trying to tease them to do the dance and get them basically have your way with them. That's men or women. And there, God tells us to watch out for that. We find those that entice unsteadfast souls. These are the people who hang out in church circles and who have ulterior motives. And that is to taunt or tease or groom, would be a modern word, the sisters or the brothers. In other words, trying to have their way with them. Many's the person that has talked with me and tell me that they've got an infatuation with some member of the church that they don't have any, certainly don't have any right to. But they're infatuated. We have to be careful in the Lord's church that we don't allow those kinds of emotional bonds to happen. And what that essentially means is don't be hugging on the sisters. And sisters, don't be hugging on the men. We need to be careful how we present ourselves, that we don't present ourselves as objects of lust one to another. Job made the statement, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look upon a maiden. This was written likely in the patriarchal age, and what Job tells us is that he had to watch his eyes. Now, that was written during a time that women, about all you could see was them peeping out through this little blind spot in their eyes. If a person could lust after someone that had a robe down to the ground and had just peeping out with their eyes, I guess if you could lust after somebody like that, then we better be really careful today, because we certainly see a lot more than that. Well, on the internet, Patrick Carnes is one of the names that you want to get familiar with in terms of pornography and sexual addiction recovery. And Patrick Carnes, actually, there's a treatment facility in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and there it's the Gratitude Program at Pine Grove in Hattiesburg. And Patrick Carnes started that. And he was a denominational preacher who was one of the very first ones that came out and said, I have a problem with pornography. And so he went, got some more education, got his habits under control, and then decided that he would teach people how he had come out and how they might be able to come out. He listed 10 different types of sexual addictions or acting out. And I won't go into all those tonight, but they're here here for you if you want to just take a look at those. But any of these can take us down the road to the wrong kinds of things. Now, here's what I want you to see from this list, is that what starts out on the screen does not stop on the screen. That there are actually 7 stages of sexual addiction. And it starts on the screen usually with just curiosity or the need to relieve ourselves stress-wise or anxiety-wise, or we're bored or we're curious. And it doesn't always start out with a sexual primary purpose. But it may be that we have learned how to use pornography like a placebo to calm our nerves, to release our feel-good chemistry in our brain, and to sexually feel satisfied. Well, if that's how we're using pornography, then we have learned how to abuse ourselves sexually in that relationship, in this pain exchange. How do we know if someone is addicted to pornography? I want to suggest in the first place, the average age where a person views the first pornography is the third grade. That would put you about 9 years old. That usually happens. If I were to ask you, how'd you learn the facts of life? That may happen because someone told us in a shower room, or we're staying over at someone's house, or we're visiting somebody, and they pop this stuff up on the screen. But whatever happens, once it gets going, now we can set in motion a chain of events that ends up with us as a pornography addict, addicted to, obsessed with pornography, with the human anatomy. And as a result, we will have trouble defining even what a woman is and what a man is. I just conducted a pornography retreat about 2 weeks ago up in Indiana. And one of the questions I asked the men that were there, the Christian men that were there, I asked the question, is a woman only good for one thing? And they all said, oh no, we don't believe that. So I asked the question then, all right, let's take sex off the table. What's a woman good for? And they haven't answered yet. And I'll tell you why. Because those men really did believe, although they denied it, they really believe a woman's only good for one thing. Now, if that's the case, then what's to stop you from looking not only at your wife, but also to be looking around? Because if a woman's only good for one thing, you may want to broaden your horizons a little bit. Because you are objectifying and sexualizing females. So I would ask the question, by the way, when I ask women, tell women what these guys said, they kind of get upset. And rightfully so. But we need to view what's a woman good for? What's a man good for? I flip the script. What's a man good for? And in your relationship, what's your husband good for? What's your wife good for? And we need to be able to answer that question with more than just the word sex. Well, all right. Here's some things that would be criteria. Viewing longer than intended, sneaking and hiding, trying to cut back, but it's still being out of control. Irritability when a person's offline, sweaty palms, and the jitters as we're coming home from work and we're thinking about maybe getting out here on the internet and checking out some porn thing. And so we've got anticipatory responses. We may have responses afterwards as well. Anxiety may enhance as we get ready to go out here on the computer, or as we anticipate satisfying ourselves sexually while watching the computer. More than one of our brethren has been arrested for pornography, where they've pulled off in a parking lot, sometime in the church parking lot, and there they have opened their laptop and they viewed pornography and be messing with himself, and up walks the cop and looks in the window, and they're just a little bit more than embarrassed. More than one of our brethren has been fired from a job at a company that has zero tolerance on pornography on company equipment, and they've lost their jobs. They probably won't tell you that. They'll probably tell you what a jerk their boss was, but some of our brethren have lost their jobs on such things as that. Man, what does that do to our testimony as children of God, as Christians, as living above the world, when we've got that kind of thing going on? And what do you tell your family? What do you tell your family? All right. Well, there are some myths about pornography. One of those is, well, you know what? It doesn't hurt anybody but me. And sometimes the partner will say, well, I'm glad they're doing that. That way they don't mess with me. And so they encourage that. That says there's a problem in the sex life and being loyal to one another and helping to satisfy one another. Some people say, well, sex with myself doesn't hurt anybody. Yes, it does. And here's how it does. Because once we have trained our brain to look at all kinds of images and to get satisfaction out of those images, then we bond ourselves to a fantasy. Here's what I mean by that. When we are going through and when our mind is focused on the sexual stuff, and we are playing with ourselves or whatever you're doing, when we do that, the brain releases a chemical that's released during sex, and it's called oxytocin. It is the bonding chemical. And when that's released, we are feeling bonded to whatever caused that to be released. If it's a picture on a screen, we are feeling bonded, connected to that because our oxytocin has been released. It's another chemical released in the brain during the sexual act, and that is one that we just abbreviate PEA. And when that's released during the heightened times, the escalated times, when this is like the fireworks in the sky kind of sexual stuff, when that's released, then again, we have bonding, but this time more intense. So when that's happening, while we're viewing pornography, or while we're down the street with some prostitute or with someone who is selling themselves or whatever's going on, when that happens, then we have bound ourselves to that person, and that will help us to keep coming back to that person or to that picture or to that event. It will bond us to come back to it. And guess what? Then when you go home to your wife or to your husband and you're sexual with that person, then we find there's three people in the bed, not two. Because one of them is up here. The show is on up here. And we click from script to script, just like we were clicking our mouse. And guess what? The person that you're with, at some level, your husband or your wife, that person knows at some level something's not right. That intimacy has been broken because we've got a third person out here in the bed with us. See that? Well, suppose we start early before we're ever married. And we start early viewing porn and learning how to satisfy ourselves by viewing porn or by being in the chat rooms. I'll come back to that in just a minute. And if we're doing that, then what's happening is from an early age before marriage, we are training our brain to be sexually satisfied with fantasy. Now, here's the story of the lie we tell ourselves. The lie is, well, you know what? When I get married, this won't be a problem anymore. And then we get married and we find out that the fantasy is greater than the reality. It competes. And so it doesn't stop just because we got married. Now we got competition going on. There is no person alive that can compete with a fantasy. A fantasy can be anything you want or any group of things you want. And there's no person alive that can compete successfully with that. So what are we doing? When we awaken sexual stuff before it's time, what we're doing is we're training our brain to accept something that God never intended for it to intended for us to accept, and we're releasing the chemistry that bonds us to that perversion. Now we got a problem. We have a real problem, because it's going to be very hard to be sexually satisfied when we have trained our brain wrong. That's why when I do treatment with people, that 90 and 90 comes up. And that is that what you need to do now, you've viewed this stuff so long that to get better, then we need to turn this off, turn your sex life off for about 90 days in order that your body chemistry and your brain can reset itself. And then we'll talk about whether you need more time than that to get back in gear. Well, a lot of folks don't like that, but tell you what, that's what's needed. And it's needed because the human body operates, not as we've just talked about, but also in the realm of supply and demand. Don't let any man tell you that he just has to be sexual because he's aching. Don't let any man tell you that, because that's not true. It's supply and demand. No one has ever died from lack of sex. No one. You can say, I told you that. All right? I know a few folks think they're going to die, or they'll tell their mate they're going to die if they don't, but they haven't died. Well, that supply and demand simply says that if the demand is great, then the body is going to rise to meet the demand. So if someone has frequent sex, then the body adjusts itself to having frequent sex. If that frequent sex is over the fantasy as well as the reality, we're going to have a lot of supply because we have a demand. So in that 90 and 90, what we do is we teach the body there's not as much demand, so the body then will adjust the supply. Now, right at first, that's going to be a problem because a person is used to a certain frequency. But the body can and will readjust. Sometimes people say, well, it doesn't hurt anybody except me. Well, a lot of excuses people use in myths about pornography. Did you know that viewing pornography releases the same chemistry into your brain that heroin and cocaine does, according to a study published in 2010? Chemistry. That's where that euphoric feeling comes from. Consistent exposure to pornography can rewire your brain. Patients with cybersex or online pornography addictions report a level of stimulation that is difficult to replicate in real life with real people. I want to look at the cycle here. When I show this to those gentlemen or people who are in pornography retreats, what they say is, that's right on. Viewing pornography is much like getting caught in a revolving door. There's a cycle. And here's the cycle. It starts out with cravings or tension. In other words, something has set us off. It may be a picture. It may be we've seen someone dressed all hoochie in the store. I did say hoochie. Out in the store. Or it may be that we're just particularly turned on that day. But whatever the deal is, something has set us off, has created a craving. Our mind, we're having a little trouble with keeping it in gear that day with proper thinking. Now, when that happens, then a person becomes susceptible to visual triggers. Usually, they'll start looking for those triggers. I'm going to look around, see if I can find someone to look at, catch a look down a blouse, or catch a look at somebody's seat of their pants as they're walking down the street, male or female. And so as a result, now we've got that visual picture. Okay, we're building this thing up. And then there is some sort of pain that goes on in terms of there's something that I need to repress. Maybe we're having a bad day. Maybe we're stressed out over something. So I need to address this particular thing that's stressing me out. Then comes the fantasy, followed by the hunt for the final objects that we're going to be looking at. Then we get into the action steps, fulfillment, and then afterwards, the letdown, usually followed by a sense of guilt. And with the guilt then, now we have this vow, man, I got to knock this off. I got to quit this. I'm going to get caught. So we have the vow, and then we settle out, and then we go right back to the top again for the next time where the craving comes. The person that gets in the pornography cycle, they follow this chain of events very predictably to where I can ask someone that's caught up in pornography addiction, where are you in the cycle right now? And they can tell me. They know what this cycle is. Well, there's an ambivalence that goes with this. All right. What is the impact of pornography on on individuals. The impact on society, 86% of convicted rapists confess to regular exposure to pornography. In other words, once the boundary is down, now we don't know where the boundary is. We may get ourselves exposed to, we don't know where the boundary is. 57% of convicted rapists try to reenact pornographic images. So this definitely has an imprint on our mind. 51% of male students exposed to violent pornography indicated the likelihood that they would rape a woman. That's 51% of male students. All right. So when we hear about things like date rape, or we hear about things like rapes or assaults, when we hear about those, a lot of those things are coming because it starts out by feeding the sexual appetite with pornography. Well, I'm going to zip through some of these. The impact of pornography is it devalues the act of marriage that is talked about and is preserved by God, that a man's desires to be toward his wife and the wife's desires to be to her husband. That's the natural thing. Without being married, sex is off the table. You agree? That means we don't go out on a date and see if we can turn each other on. It's off the table. If you want that, then we need to have a conversation about marriage. And if you don't want to marry me, we don't need to have that conversation at all. Do you ever notice that in our culture, when the conversation turns to sex, getting acquainted on an intimate level with people, that turns off? Once a relationship turns sexual, the growth of intimacy, getting to know one another as people, it often just kind of goes away. Well, when we devalue, we may have humiliating sexual acts. These things can do damage to our marriage, create unrealistic demands, and I'm zipping through this because I have the wrong PowerPoint up here tonight. So bear with me. I'm trying to fake this one. All right, but we have damages to the marriage. All right, the danger to the individual is not only that we have retrained the brain, but that to focus on the fantasy. But now a danger is this leads to social isolation. In other words, when we have a fantasy or an infatuation toward what's on the screen, then what we can do is we don't have to have a human-to-human contact. We have fantasy going on, and so we have social isolation. When we're out here looking at pornography, there's a loss to the family, a family time. There's the guy or the woman is out here looking on the screen and spending their time out here in fantasy land. I need to say this. There was a Barna study conducted by a fundamental religious organization, fundamentalist, and it was conducted about 3 years ago. The Barna study, you can hunt that up online, it's about a 42-page findings. And in that particular study, what they concluded is 63% of churched men, that's men who go to church regularly in fundamental kind of churches, that includes us, 63% of those men view pornography daily. 42% of the women are involved in pornography daily. Now, there's a difference in the two groups. The difference in how I'm defining how pornography is defined. The men will go to the pictures and movie sites because they primarily are stimulated by sight. The women, the majority of women who go out on the sites for pornography are going to the relationship sites. Now, by that, I mean they're going to the chat rooms. They're going where you can get involved in a blog, or they're looking for relationship, not so much visual stimulation, although sometimes that's the case. So they're going to the relationship. So then what we'll find often is women falling in love with somebody they met on the internet. Now, obviously, men have to be at those sites too if they're falling in love with some man on the internet. But men will go to those sites because that's where you pick up a woman. So we see men and women who are churched that go there. What's the numbers amongst us in the churches of Christ? I don't know, but I do know that the biggest part of my private practice with Christians, the number one issue is pornography. And what that means, and I have a healthy practice, what that means is if those are just a sample of what's amongst us, then we have a serious problem amongst us. And it's one that we aren't likely to talk about, but it needs to be talked about. Because the devil is doing a number on our congregations in terms of that pornography stuff. Well, how do we address this issue? What's the church supposed to do? I'm going to leave the PowerPoints and you look at them yourself. What is the church supposed to do on stuff like this? What I have recommended in a number of places is instead of us looking down our nose and say, well, that's horrible and you guys are scuzzy and we don't want you in the congregation. Instead of doing that, I believe that like any other sin, we need to embrace and help those people that are caught up in this stronghold of Satan. How do we do that? Well, I want to suggest that one of the first ways is that we need to be transparent with each other. We need to acknowledge that we have a problem. And that we are not the only one in a congregation that has the problem. Now, you don't need to tell other people that. But in congregations where there are people that will acknowledge they have a problem looking at stuff they ought not to look at, then you will find not just one, you'll find more than one. There's one congregation I was at, there's about 300 people in that congregation. And in that weekend, 15 of the men in the congregation acknowledged they had a problem. You know what we did? Instead of berating all of them, they were repentant, and their wives were angry because, well, their wives already knew it. They didn't pop that on them at all. But what we did is we started a group, a support group, right there in the congregation. And they came, and at first the elders didn't want them to meet in the building, but then later they recanted on that. But what they did basically is they began studying. What does the Bible say about this? How do I keep myself pure? How do we get a handle on this thing to where it's not a problem? When I'm weak, who do I call? And who can give me help? And this particular group, what they did is they, a little bit more savvy electronically than I am, what they did is they had an app on their phone where when one of them was in trouble and about to act out sexually, what they would do is hit their app, I call it their bat phone, and what it would do is it would go off, and you know, within just a few seconds, there'd be four or five members of the church calling them. Well, that group has done fairly well. There's been some relapse amongst them, but for the most part, they're doing well. You know what? Those 15 men, none of them knew that the other people had the problem. They thought they were the only one. But they're not. They're amongst us. Well, there's other places that we've done the same thing, studying such things. Every Man's Battle is one of the books that's a pretty good book to study in some of those groups. There are other things to study, and I can suggest some of those at another time. But having a support system that is there to help individuals, that 90 and 90, in other words, that we make a commitment not to be sexually active, even with our wife, for 90 days. Now, the wives need to agree to that. But what that basically does is it takes sex off the table. And during that time, husbands and wives are doing a tremendous job of getting reacquainted with each other without the sexual stuff. Then you can plug that back in at whatever interval that needs to go into. But that's how some people are dealing with this. Other people have decided that they will install used to be Covenant Eyes that people, we told people to install. That hasn't had the highest ratings lately. The one that does is Ever Accountable, and that has high ratings. What you do is it's recommended that you have one of the members of the church who is technically savvy to install that app on the phone and to put a passcode on that's only known to the person that installed it, not to the person using it. Here's what it does. Anytime that you use your phone for something that is sexually inappropriate, then the person you designate will automatically get a phone call and say, "Hey, did you know Art's watching porn?" Well, guess what? If that came across, I would be getting a phone call from that person or from perhaps several people. If you have several people on there. That's what Ever Accountable does. I prefer that one over Covenant Eyes, but either one of them will work. So there are some things that people can do to address these issues. Above all, what we have to do is to realize that we've got to be in an abstinent phase. We've got to restudy kind of what does the Bible teach on human sexuality. And we need to watch our eyes, watch our thoughts, and to learn to be grateful. And someone says, what's gratefulness have to do with any of this? I have never seen a pornography addict who is grateful. That's what it has to do with it. Because as we rob ourselves of that relationship with God, we begin to get more and more negative, and we are pulled away in our character erosion, and we're pulled into a time that we are very negative, and thus the need for gratitude. I personally believe that we need to start every day by identifying at least three things we're grateful for today. Not the same things as yesterday. Three things that we're grateful for. You'll be amazed how many things you've got to be grateful for. And maybe one of those would be your marriage partner. I'm thankful this person stuck with me. I'm thankful for the love and the devotion that is here in our family. When's the last time you said that? You see, we can become ungrateful for the things that we have, and thus the need to show gratitude one to another. Well, what are some things we can do also in terms of how to help one another? I want to suggest first, it is not a sin to be tempted. Everybody gets tempted. It is a sin to yield to temptation. So we may look at such things as the support groups, as how can the congregation help? In the community, there is a group called SA, Sex Addicts Anonymous. It's much like Alcoholics Anonymous, and there'll be one around here somewhere. They're not usually advertised in the paper, but they're here. Check it out on the internet. You can find them. And going to those groups, it is necessary to have a network of people who are going to hold you accountable and help you to be sober in terms of sexual addiction. That network of people often is found in such group as Sex Addicts Anonymous. SA or SAA, either one of those would carry you there. Sometimes the language in these meetings is not the best. And a lot of folks say, well, I don't want to go there because I have to listen to a bunch of trash talk. Well, while I am not encouraging trash talk, sometimes we have to overlook some things because we have to look at greater things. And that is our conduct. And we may have to overlook that. We hear that kind of talk in the world all the time. We don't want to talk that way. But if that bothers you, then there are some other groups that we can go to that will help us with this. If you are a person who has been betrayed in your marriage by a mate who is caught up in a sexual addiction, there is a group that is the counterpart of SAA and it is S-Anon, like Al-Anon, it's S-Anon, and Sex Addicts Anonymous. And basically that group is there as a support to the betrayed spouse. And they will help you, and you'll have a sponsor, and you'll follow the same 12 steps and so forth. I recommend those two groups very highly. I would also recommend Accountability Partners. Accountability Partner is someone that you've designated, you've told them what your problem is, and you have asked them to check in with you and to help you to be accountable for your conduct, and someone that you can be honest with and that will demand honesty of you. And you check in with these people or this person. And basically, if you slip, if you go back to your old ways, let them know. And that way we catch it quickly instead of waiting until it's way down the road again. But whatever the case, we are not going to be able to be in recovery from sexual addiction or any other addiction if we are keeping our secret. We are only as sick as the secrets we keep. So we need to share our secret. We need to tell our story. But we don't need necessarily to tell it to everybody, but to those people that are going to be able to help us and encourage us through that. That'd be the same with any addiction. Now, I'm going to sound kind of like I'm commercial in this. There are a number of places on your web that you can go and get some help. One of those is called Faithful and True. Go to faithfulandtrue.com, and there at Faithful and True, you'll find a number of workbooks. You'll find retreats and workshops, all kinds of things that are there. They're a little pricey, but they're worth it. Mark and Debbie Lacer are the individuals that run that site. We've talked about Patrick Carnes and Pine Grove. They have a program called the Gratitude Program, and it is a 45-day program for people who are sexually addicted. And this is where I'm going to sound commercial. If you will go to my site called leavingthepitbehind.org, what you will find is in the Academy section and the Forum section, you will find an educational section under the Academy, and you will find under the Forums a discussion section where people who have the problem can go in there and interact with other Christians who have the problem. Those sites are overseen. They're proctored by someone in the church who has had that very problem but is way into their recovery. In most cases, at least 4 years into their recovery. They've been there, done that, and they're pulling out of it. And they can help you because you're a few steps behind them if you're one of those people. You can go to those sites. Those are pay sites. The price on those is fairly minimal. Watch for retreats. Watch for workshops. And also watch for therapy sessions that at the same site that you can schedule those. Most of those are with me, but there's 12 of us, and there's other people out there that can assist in that. Enough of the commercial. But there is help out there for our brethren. And if you want help, if you really want to get better, you don't have to do it by yourself. There is help available and resources available to each of us. Well, as Job made a covenant with his eyes that he might not look upon a maiden to sin, even so we as God's children have to especially be cautious and careful at a time like this. When our stress levels, our anxiety, our depression, our anger, when those things get high, our ability to control ourselves starts getting lower. And for some, it takes people to the internet, and that can take us to the self-soothing stuff that happens in the realm of pornography. Let us be careful. We can go to heaven without a computer. We can go to heaven without a cell phone. We can go to heaven without any electronic device. We can go to heaven without going to the movies. And so if those things are a problem to us, then that is part of the price of the sacrifice that we pay in order to present our body as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. And guess what? That's your reasonable service. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Do you need to respond to something tonight? You just pray with you. I wonder sometime if there's any sinners amongst us. No one seems like, or a lot of times no one seems like they want us to pray for them. Or that they need to acknowledge, hey, I need some help here. Any sinners here tonight? If you're one and you'd like for us to pray with you or for you, we'll be glad to do that. We'll do that afterwards too if you want to do it then. But by all means, let us be careful that we guard our minds and keep our minds pure. Pure in heart, O God, help us to be. Can we help you get your mind right? And can you come to the front while we stand and as we sing?